I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. When he was only 15, Andy Lipkus organized his first tree planting while attending Jewish summer camp. More than 30 years later, Andy Lipkus is still planting. As head of Tree People, a Los Angeles effort to protect the urban forest and restore watersheds and fragile habitats. Today, we'll find out about the organization's latest efforts to turn the city into a sustainable ecosystem and what other cities can learn from Andy's efforts. Also with us is Mike Kaslin, who is on a mission to turn students across America into entrepreneurs in his work with the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship. We'll be back with Smart City guest, Tree People founder Andy Lipkus, and Mike Kaslin with NFTE right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Andy Lipkus is founder of Tree People. It seems like a natural role for Andy since he's been planting trees literally all his life. Tree People is based in Los Angeles, and its mission is to inspire the people of that city to take personal responsibility for the urban forest. Andy, you organized your first planting at Jewish summer camp when you were only 15. What sparked your interest then?
I grew up in Los Angeles. I was born and raised here, and we had really bad smog back then. This was before the air quality was measured. I just knew that on typical days, I would play and come home with burning lungs, and I would boil a pot of water and breathe steam to get relief. And my parents then would send me to the mountains up at 8,000-foot elevation camp every summer to get away from the smog, where we could really play and enjoy ourselves without feeling that pain. And when I turned 15, after many years of respite in that forest, we learned that that same smog was killing the trees as they were filtering the air and producing oxygen for us. We were told that the rate that the trees were dying was so fast that by the year 2000, if nothing was done, that the forest would be gone. We were told that nobody was actually doing anything about it. Just researchers had discovered it and known it for a couple of years. But it would be up to us kids to do something to save the forest if we cared. And the rangers had found smog-resistant trees existed and suggested maybe we could plant them. And so we began doing it. Something was just so powerful about working with other 15, 16-year-olds who've been getting that message all through life. Even though teachers said, you can make a difference, adults, everyone around us seemed to all feel like, no, you can't make a difference. You can't fight City Hall. And we took a dead piece of land in our camp, and we stripped up soil that had been soaked with oil for years and opened up the real soil and sowed seeds and planted grass and planted smog-resistant trees. And in 3 weeks' time, we saw life return to this what was a barren parking lot baseball field. We created a beautiful park. I thought, I need to keep doing this, and I need to get more kids involved. And I haven't stopped.
And it's how many years later?
Well, it's 35.
35. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of good causes. How did you get the attention of funders and volunteers for this one, the cause of planting trees?
Well, I just put the word out and people joined in. I think because we don't do politics in the normal way, we make this a meeting ground for people from the right and the left and of various colors and persuasions. This is a place where everyone can come to. And I think because we don't have philosophical barriers and political barriers, it's easy for people to come and take that first step and not worry about having to shed whatever their religion and their politics is that keeps them apart. That's one. Two, I think people are aware of the problem and the pain, and they don't see pathways to participate. And I think everyone needs to feel like they make a difference. You know, I think there's something in us that compels us to help heal. That's why we seek good news and good information, because part of the question is, where am I needed? Where can I help? And we've opened up this really simple pathway. We call the simple act of planting a tree. It's far from simple in truth, but the first action, maybe planting a tree in a forest or a park, is pretty light. The actions get more difficult as time goes by, as we can talk about, but we did create that safe space, and people connected with community. They connected with friends. They made new friends. And in tremendous joy comes back. And there's also just this element that we've noticed over and over again is that people are tired after a week of work. and they try to restore. The interesting thing about this work is that it's like recycling your energy. Somehow, even though you might work your butt off for 8 hours swinging picks and stuff like that, you wind up with more energy than you put in when the day is over. And that alone has built a lot of momentum and brought a lot of people into the project.
How many people are now involved with your work?
Whoa. Well, we have about 15,000 members. We have several thousand volunteers on a regular basis. And our staff is around 40. But we reach out to tens of thousands, sometimes up to a million school kids a year through our education program. Now, that education program has been built, so it's now a partnership with the County of Los Angeles and the City of Los Angeles. From time to time, they put out a contract to educate the population about stormwater pollution or waste reduction. And if we're lucky enough and skilled enough to write a proposal that gets funded, then that's when we get to really scale up to reach large, large numbers. Our mission is to inspire people to participate in making this a sustainable urban environment. And that's our challenge, but that is what guides us. So we want to involve a lot of people.
You've talked about planting trees. You've talked about the education work you do. But my sense is that's not the whole of it. Tell me what else you do at Tree People.
The context is that we are working to inspire and activate people to get in touch with that power that we all have. And we're doing it with the end result of understanding that this city is one of the most destructive cities on the planet because of the amount of people here, the amount of energy that we use per capita, therefore the amount of global warming gas we put out, the amount of water we consume per capita, and that we have to suck water from the entire Southwest, from as far away as Montana, to bring into Los Angeles. And that a lot of these problems are based on not anyone's bad intention, but bad design, and not being literate about the environment when the city was built. We didn't understand that we built a city on top of a living, functioning ecosystem. And so our work is to make the place sustainable by repairing the land and by activating the millions of people here to play a role as part of the ecosystem, as managers of the watershed and the airshed. Those are a lot of words. It really means changing people's perspective that instead of being a victim and instead of being a user of the environment, that they are a full-on participant citizen, that it's not going to get better without them, that the paradigm that we've been living in, that government is mom, that's going to fix the problems that we create and give us everything we need, well, it's not possible. Government can't be big enough to make up for the size of negative impacts we're having on ourselves, on our health, on our economy, and then on the environment around Los Angeles and out in the world because of the very heavy impact we have. So that's where we start. And from there we go, okay, how do we educate people? How do we inspire people? We do it with kids. There's more than 80 languages spoken in Los Angeles schools. There's 160 nations living in Los Angeles. I mean, communities from 160 nations. When a politician gets on the radio and speaks in English, they don't reach most of the population anymore. So we have built an amazing scaffold of an education system into classrooms and community organizations where we're taking messages and delivering them in English, sometimes Spanish, actually sometimes 8 different languages, including American Sign and Tagalog and Chinese. And to the kids, often mostly to the kids, to take home to their families to translate and to translate into awareness and action and change. Without being complicated by politics, it's very, very effective. One example is we helped build LA City's curbside recycling program. This was back in the 80s. Everyone knew and believed that nobody would recycle here. And we said, well, we think people might. And we took the message to the kids to convert their families. When LA planned its program, the best recycling program in the whole country only got 30% participation of its population. And they expected maybe 15 or 20% of LA's population would participate. But we said, give us a shot at it, and we're going to reach a critical mass of the youth population to take it home. In 2 years' time, we reached 250,000 kids, put on a teacher education program in service, did all kinds of intensive work. Well, in those 2 years, the kids did their work. And when the city program rolled out, 90% of the population participated in the recycling. It blew everyone away. That was the power of kids when you say you do make a difference. You can make a difference. Take action. And that bolstered our understanding of our responsibility and the power of working smartly. So now we're going much, much deeper. Tree People has also mobilized communities to respond in disaster. We had El Nino caused floods here in 1978 and 1980 that destroyed hundreds of homes in landslides. We mobilized thousands of volunteers, including very untraditional partners, four-wheel drive clubs, construction people, students, environmentalists, a number of people who wouldn't normally get together. And in 1980, 3,000 of those volunteers, we formed an army that actually saved over 1,200 homes. It's part of that we pulled together ham radio operators who built a radio communication network that replaced the ones for police and fire that broke in the storms. Not unlike what you saw happen in Katrina, but in this case, the community responded, formed a network that we even put ham radio operators in some police cars and fire trucks to help bridge that gap. But, you know, this is just an example of what a community can do when it comes together, when it tells the truth about its problems and faces them and figures out a way to participate. And the thing that's so interesting about this is in our society today, because of insurance and litigiousness, cities tend not to use volunteers. If we have a brush or a forest fire here, we will fly firefighters in from Idaho and Washington and Colorado and maybe even the East Coast before we'll use volunteers. And so as a nonprofit organization, it's quite refreshing for people to hear the invitation to step forward, join hands, and make something happen.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Andy Lipkus. He's founder of Tree People. Andy, just a quick question about your education program. You describe its result in a very powerful way, and yet I know that some people who have produced education programs are saying that now that the focus is so strongly on testing and finding out academic achievement results and measuring that, that they're having trouble getting programs into schools or continuing those successful programs in schools. Have you found that to be the case?
Absolutely. We are finding doors closing, teachers really demoralized by this threat on the testing. And what we've had to do is work really, really hard and rework all of our curriculum and get it to match the state standards, be certified by the state. We've actually been designated by the state of California as the regional coordinator of environmental education activities. It's a network the state formed called CREEC, California Regional Environmental Education Community. And it's broken down to counties in various regions, but in the LA County area, we lead the region. And there's about 250 various environmental ed service providers. What we've done is band together and rework our curriculum so it delivers the math skills, the science skills, the English language skills that are required. And from all testing that's been done, it continues to show that when you offer the environment as a context for learning, kids learn and retain more. They do better on the tests. And so for those teachers who join in our county-sponsored program called Generation Earth, it's our partnership with Los Angeles County Public Works, we give teachers the skills, we take them through the process so they feel the confidence and it works. But no doubt we're having less access just because of the intimidation and a lot of, frankly, demoralized teachers who are so frustrated. But the passionate ones keep on fighting and work with us.
You mentioned the litigious nature of our society. Government flies in firefighters from Iowa rather than take on volunteers for fear of getting sued. That's reasonable in our world today. I'm wondering, let's go back to the simplest thing you do, perhaps, which is planting a tree. And as you say, that's not always simple. And I'm assuming that there are many times where you have to work in concert with government. You're on government land, I suppose, or in rights of way.
Always.
So have you created a relationship which makes that easy to duplicate over and over again?
Yes, though there's always issues. We have to work with government all the time, and we love it, and sometimes it's very frustrating. Because I guess, again, I'm going to use that word paradigm. We have a new paradigm response. And by the way, I love that in the name of the show, of Smart City, because it speaks of new paradigm, making cities work smart. Cities are ecosystems, and connecting the people and connecting the government together is what we need to do. The challenge is some people are of old world, both in the population and in government, and they think maybe that we're indicting them by saying, hey, we want to help. And it's not that they're not doing their job. It's just that the job can't be done without people. So we have to cross that hurdle a lot. We actually have a training called the Citizen Forester Training, where we train neighborhood leaders how to communicate with government, how to raise money, why they have to get permits, to understand that process, and then how to work with the bureaucracy, which inadvertently usually shuts down citizen efforts. We have packaged this training. It used to take 5 weekends, and now I think we've got it down to 2.5 days, where any citizen learns how to take a dream and work with their neighbors to build it into reality, including having city trucks and permits and partners out there to help make it happen. And we have helped spread this around the country by supporting other organizations. We're part of a network called the Alliance for Community Trees, which has partner groups in about 50 cities around the United States. They're not all exact clones of tree people. We decided that the work needs to be local, just like a native tree. You know, that there are problems, issues, money that are specifically local, and we stay focused on this, but we take the pollen, if you will, of some of our technologies and share them with others. They can stand on our shoulders and not have to reinvent the wheel. The thing is that the real breakthrough and the real challenge was when we discovered that there was a glass ceiling, if you will. We got lots of neighborhoods involved doing tree planting and greening, and that was great. And neighborhoods were looking better. But we discovered that we weren't fixing the underlying problems that were affecting quality of life in the city. The trees were merely treated as decorations rather than units and machines of sustainability, which they really are in the world. They are our life support system. And so when we saw that Los Angeles, as I mentioned, one of our huge issues is water. The city of LA spends close to $1 billion a year to import and distribute water, wherein at the very same time we receive half the water we need in rainfall, but we throw almost all of it away, like 85% of it, and we pollute it and we create flooding problem. And so all these multiple costs and challenges based on how we deal with water. And I knew that forestry always had something to do with watershed management. But when I heard about the need that the Army Corps of Engineers came to town because we had this huge flooding problem, because we'd so now overpaved the city that it was threatened with the LA River overflowing with the next 50-year rain event. And I tried, when I saw that, could trees do something, I realized that we could actually be practicing urban watershed management. Now, that would be a smart city. The challenge was that no agencies worked together because they all had different missions, different levels of government. So the Water Supply Agency, $1 billion a year, the Flood Control Agency's budget was $500 million a year, and they were throwing away and polluting $500 million worth of water. Those two agencies didn't talk to each other. A third agency, from the perspective of a forester, big, big factor would be our Department of Sanitation. Green waste or mulch. Mulch in a forest is your primary sponge, water clarifier, cleanser, water conservation element. Well, their only job was to pick up all this green waste and haul it to the landfill. 40% of LA's waste stream is green waste, is biomass, is mulch, is gold from our perspective. But they weren't part of the conversation either. So I actually began trying to get the agencies to talk to each other. And everybody said, well, you know, we're not supposed to. That's what turf and bureaucracy is about. And so I actually got a grant from the U.S. Forest Service and to demonstrate that it was technically and economically feasible to actually retrofit L.A., to manage it as a living ecosystem and as a watershed. And it took 8 years. Their challenge grant of $150,000, we were able to bring in various partner agencies and assembled a total of $1 million from our Department of Water and Power and our Bureau of Engineering and Street Maintenance and the County Public Works Department and various agencies, including the EPA and some very diverse groups. And we brought 100 of the best minds in engineering, in architecture, landscape architecture, and biology. We brought them together for a design collaborative called a charrette back in 1997, brought a brilliant mind in smart thinking, Paul Hawken, into Los Angeles. And together with another great landscape architect from University of British Columbia, we led this think fest for 4 days to redesign LA to be, in fact, a smart city with the goal of reducing our water importation by half by completely consuming all the water from a 100-year storm, cleaning it and reusing it instead of letting it go, completely consuming that green waste stream and using it, for positive means, profoundly reducing our energy use by shading and cooling the city and reducing our global warming impact. And these people worked together in teams for 4 days and came up with our assignment was they had to come up with very practical tools and best management practices where you could retrofit every home, apartment, commercial, industrial, and public property. And we did it. And in fact, it was so good that the city and the county adopted some of those as official best management practices. We demonstrated one on a house in South Los Angeles where we retrofit the home and we brought in a tanker truck, 4,000 gallons of water, and a bunch of public agency officials. And we created a flash flood on that house. It was a 1,500-year storm. And we gave all the officials umbrellas and we turned on the flood.
That's a great scene.
It was. It blew their minds because none of the water left the property.
Wow.
All of the pollution that would normally flow and everything was all captured there, treated in various little mulched bioswale that we put in, a driveway dry well, just putting a little drain across the driveway to pick up the water and put it into a sand filter box under the lawn. We put berms only 6 inches high around the lawn and planted them. We, you know, for $5, we bent the downspout of the drain, the roof drains, into the lawn instead of the driveway. I invented a cistern that fits in the backyard fence made out of recycled plastic, which holds thousands of gallons of water, and then that goes right into the irrigation system. And so when they saw that all these systems could actually converge in one neat, very achievable, very elegant, simple system on every home, it opened the door and melted the resistance, and we entered into new partnerships.
Andy, well, you've created a great model for other cities. The name of the organization is Tree People. Andy Lipkus has been our guest. Thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Well, it's been great.
Andy Lipkus is president and founder of Tree People. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Mike Kaslin from the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship, and we'll talk to Otis White about the latest news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Congestion is a top complaint by citizens everywhere, but people are reluctant to get on buses. Why?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. There seems to be a lot of things that people associate with buses. Sometimes it's a class thing. They really think that if you're middle class, you don't ride buses. You might ride rail transit, but buses are kind of something that poorer people do. It could be comfort. That is, if it's raining and cold, waiting for a bus is a pretty miserable experience. And it could be convenience. That is, I've got to be somewhere quickly, and I don't know how soon this bus is going to be here. So there are always a lot of factors that tend to make people not want to take buses. But there's another factor which transit systems don't concentrate enough on, and that is the feeling of safety. And particularly women riders have great concerns about waiting in certain places for buses because they don't feel safe there. And there's a professor at UCLA who's the national expert at studying, of all things, bus stop safety. And she wrote a paper recently about what makes bus stops more appealing and appearing safe, particularly for women. And her recommendations are all very common sense stuff, like closing liquor stores and adult bookstores and cleaning up graffiti and getting more retail on streets where bus stops are located so that people feel more comfortable there. Now, what's interesting about this, Carol, is while this is all very good common sense stuff, absolutely none of it is actually controlled by the transit authorities themselves. That is, they can make their buses a little bit more comfortable, and they can market them, and they can do things that deal with the other factors. But when it comes to safety, they very much depend on the cities around them to help out with this. And this seems to be what one of the great problems is for bus systems. They don't reach out to the cities that they serve, to the city governments, and enlist them as allies in making bus service work much better. And that seems to be the problem just about around the country.
It's a very interesting paper. After I saw the reference in your work, I took a look at it, and I think she's got some great ideas that cities need to pay attention to. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
We'll be right back. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Mike Caslin is CEO and Executive Director with the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship. He is an entrepreneur and had established ventures in the Aqua Farm, video production, crisis and corporate turnaround management services, and real estate sectors before taking a leave of absence to help NFTE. Mike, how do you teach entrepreneurship?
The mission of NFTE is to teach entrepreneurship to young people from low-income communities to enhance their economic productivity, and we do that by improving their business, academic, and life skills. And we teach entrepreneurship. We've been at it for about 19 years, and we have identified what I would call the code of wealth creation. The genius of the founder of NFTE, Steve Mariotti, was that he took his MBA curriculum that he had from the University of Michigan, and he shared it with young people in the South Bronx in an area called Fort Apache at a Jane Addams Vocational High School in 1988 and saw some profound pickup on the concepts and the behaviors of young people towards entrepreneurship. And this is, again, in 88 when entrepreneurship education hadn't seen the great support. It's building, though. That one classroom now has increased to where we now have close to 3,700 teachers in 31 states and 14-plus countries. That first year, we worked with about 100 students. This year, we'll educate about 28,000 students in the process of entrepreneurship. Cumulatively, we've worked with about 120,000 students over 19 years. The way we teach entrepreneurship is to, first of all, help young people understand the key code words, the key concepts of the entrepreneurial language. Much of what NFTE does is about creating an entrepreneurial culture in the mindset and in the hearts and minds of young people who come from low-income families who have not had a tradition of owning assets and creating businesses. And we're trying to create first-generation entrepreneurs amongst those families through working with teenagers at the high school and sometimes at the middle school level. We have a very rigorous program model that takes anywhere from 50 to 108 hours of training. We have a very rigorous curriculum that's been recognized with the Golden Lamp Award as the outstanding educational resource. It's been recognized by Pearson Publishers as the number one curriculum for entrepreneurship in the country. And we've been embraced by hundreds of school districts in the United States and abroad. We have an hour-by-hour syllabus, lesson plans for our teachers. The strategy we use is basically to take the wealth creation concepts that are taught at the highest levels of the graduate and undergraduate schools, such as Stanford, Harvard, Babson, the University of Michigan, and to simplify them, those concepts, for young people in the high school and middle school grades. And then what we work on is creating experiential activities that young people can test and apply these ideas and concepts in their real life. We help young people identify their passion and try and turn their hobbies and passions into small businesses in their community in real time. And the students actually control the development of their company through a very rigorous NFTE workbook, basically business planning workbook. And we also have business plan competitions. And the students really engage in meeting the needs, the local needs of the community, by applying their unique view of the world, their unique insights to meeting those needs.
So you believe entrepreneurs are made and not born?
In 1978, there were two courses offered in the entire United States on entrepreneurship, and they were offered at the college level at Northeastern and Babson College. Today, there's over 450 colleges and universities around the world that offer full majors. So there's been a great, what I would call, scientific revolution, if you will, an age of entrepreneurial enlightenment coming forward, where entrepreneurship process has been researched very rigorously. It has been documented, and it's been packaged in better and better, more effective ways. And we do think that young people, especially those born into communities of need, may be gifted in the field of entrepreneurship because it addresses a real critical issue of necessity-driven entrepreneurs. There's also a segment of the entrepreneurial community basically viewed as opportunity-driven entrepreneurs. Those are the two key segments, and we're finding that young people who come to the NFTE program, and we target high schools in high density areas that have basically school free and reduced lunch. We try and target those high schools that have the great populations in need. They're like our Juilliard schools. They're just acres of diamonds for young people to tap their innate genius and capabilities. So we think that entrepreneurs can be nurtured. They can be made self-aware. And entrepreneurship process can be transmitted and learned. We've done 9 external evaluations and internal assessments since we first were founded in 1988. We worked with Brandeis University Heller School and Harvard Graduate School of Education Center for At-Risk Youth. We've been able to prove that business knowledge can be transferred. So in essence, it can be taught and it can be received. That business knowledge can be applied in changes of behavior, i.e. students launching their own microenterprises, earning money for themselves and their family. We've also been able to prove that by learning entrepreneurship, it changes the lens of a young person in their approach towards education. And we are able to show that students see education and schooling as far more relevant, far more empowering, far more essential for their own betterment in life. And so we're able to see aspirations towards higher education actually go up amongst NIFTY students. Engagement in school go up as well.
How does your program, Mike, differ from what I remember as Junior Achievement?
I would view NIFTY as a great pre- or post-junior achievement program. Junior Achievement is a great colleague in the field with us. They have a broad service span of economic education and applied economic theory. NIFTY is very, very narrow in our focus. We focus on youth in need in low-income communities. We focus on a teacher-driven, teacher-delivered program that's volunteer-enhanced. We have a very rigorous NIFTY University certification program. That's between 3 to 5 days of training, sometimes 4, where the teachers actually become certified as NIFTY teachers. We have a very clear and rigorous business plan process for each student within the class. We have a sole proprietor model that basically every student has to, in our opinion, master the core basics of business by understanding the elements that come into the business planning process. Economics of one unit, how that transfers into an income statement, a philanthropy plan, a marketing plan, and how their particular product or service can be delivered in an effective way to their customers. So I think we're complementary, but I think we also have a very, very important and focus on trying to reach out and serve the millions of young people who are living at or below the poverty level in America and around the world.
What kinds of businesses do students typically start?
Within the NIFTY curriculum, we've identified many business models that a young person can start. We first try and help them understand the difference between an entrepreneur and an employee. We help them understand what possibly the entrepreneurial characteristics they may have as strengths and how they can play to that within a business idea. We help them start to do an inventory of their own passions and interests and then look at the needs of the community and try and match those up and then create a business model around that. So our students have created tutoring companies, dance companies. In certain parts of the country, we have the small and light production facilities of making birdhouses, or basically a young man kept bees out in Wichita, Kansas, and was able to develop a whole bee wax product company. We have a young woman who has a website design template company, many national award winners who have jewelry company, and many of our older alums have a number of different types of businesses ranging from service of hair care to production of clothing to production restaurant tours.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Michael Kaslin. He is CEO and Executive Director of the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship, or as he calls it, NIFTY. Mike, the failure rate of new businesses is very high, as you know. I mean, wouldn't people with limited experience, limited education, limited financial resources be better off working for someone else?
I think in another day, another time, that premise might have some semblance of validity. But I think the economy is functionally different, certainly, today. In a couple of different ways, I think that being entrepreneurial and learning entrepreneurship is actually an essential life skill, far more than ever before. The students, first of all, have tremendous passion and tremendous potential for growth. They haven't been burdened by a variety of what I would call possibly adult challenges. So first of all, we really are tapping into a very, very energetic pool of people. The second aspect is that the learning what it takes to be an owner of a business is so profoundly important as it relates to having an entrepreneurial mindset. And if you have an entrepreneurial mindset, you will be valuable and far more competitive in, quote, competing for traditional employment, which many of our students do while they're going to school. They're working part-time. They're doing their microenterprise. They're finishing school. And they're actually far more competitive to gain in traditional employment if they are entrepreneurially empowered and literate. We also find that many of our students have challenges throughout their communities, and they want to be in control of something. And in essence, entrepreneurship helps them become their own boss, that they really start to see that they have control over their lives, not only through their own micro-enterprise business idea, but also in what they're choosing to develop themselves. We have goal setting as part of the curriculum and life planning and philanthropy planning, and that really all starts to create a holistic self-development process, far more than just simply looking for a entry-level, low-wage job. We encourage our students, as they become nifty empowered, to work at any job if someday you're going to own that company. So once you start to have an ownership attitude, all learning experiences and all job opportunities really just can be taken to another level.
Mm-hmm. Do you expect the students that you teach to become adult entrepreneurs? Do you consider that as part of your success or failure?
Carol, we have a detailed, what's called a nifty theory of change. We have very rigorous expectations of our teachers who are trained. We have expectations of them going back to the classroom and delivering very, very clear experiences for our students. We have clear student outcomes as it relates to completion of a business plan and defending that in class. We then look at, as the students progress through school, we want to be supportive of them, and we have an alumni services program as well for every graduate of the program who chooses to go to our website and sign on. That then opens them up towards ongoing community college and college opportunities. And then over time, we think that we're fulfilling our mission of helping young people become economically self-sufficient if they are able to continue schooling, if they are able to gain employment, or if they are able to employ themselves through their own business. So as you can see, we have a number of different outcomes towards being productive and responsible in society. And our society is a democratic, capitalistic society, small d, small c. And that society hinges on the number of productive and responsible and self-governing people per capita, per community. And if we can help more and more young people understand how they fit in that community and in the marketplace, I think we can have a chance for a much stronger nation. Over the years, we've had many, many key sponsors that have believed in this. We have now have over 2,000 sponsors from the private sector that believe that this is a very, very important element for making our communities and our nation stronger. The other good news is the New York City Council, nifty New York metro area, enabled us with a grant of $510,000 to increase by 1,000 students this year the number of young people learning entrepreneurship. So 4,500 young people across New York City and each of the 51 city council districts will now be empowered in entrepreneurship. And this is a growing effort. This is a historic vote by one of the most powerful city councils in the world, recognizing that in order to have a stronger community, a stronger city, more entrepreneurial economy, they have to invest. And investing in nifty across the city is something that council members and state senators Bruno and Maltese really are getting behind. So I think this is now being viewed as an essential building element for a much stronger and much more competitive nation.
You take teachers and you put them through your certification program. Do they ever bolt the classroom and become entrepreneurs themselves?
There's a lot of different impacts when a teacher sees the world through an entrepreneurial lens. The teachers become far more innovative, far more experiential-oriented, far more resource-leveraged-oriented. We have, on occasion, almost every few years, teachers that do take so much to heart all the nifty curriculum and tools that they do launch businesses. However, the broader aspect that we're very thrilled about is that our teacher retention rates are going up, our activation rates are sustaining, that we really are seeing that teachers in communities across America and in basically global regions of Latin America, Caribbean, Africa, Middle East, Europe, CIS, and Asia Pacific, where we have nifty programs, teachers are seeing that this is an important part of their future career, so that they're seeing that being an entrepreneurship teacher is a very noble endeavor and worthy of their time and exciting because they're joining a very cutting-edge and cool community.
If you strip it all away, Mike, what is the key to being a successful entrepreneur?
I think, very simply, it could be hearts and minds, where you have to have the heart and the conviction and the will, the determination, the motivation, the clarity of purpose to go after your dream in a very, very committed way. And then you have to have a strong mind that's eager and thirsty for learning the skills and tools, the insights, and the humility to ask for help and to seek help and to get it. We have many, many thousands of volunteer hours at Nifty, folks from the business community and the academic community, university partners such as the University of Chicago and Babson and Stanford, where students are donating their time to help develop our students into great entrepreneurs in the future. So I think it is a combination of heart and mind, that they have to have the will, the endurance, the motivation and passion, and then they have to get rigorous in their skill building to become strong and enduring entrepreneurs.
Your founder, Steve Mariotti, has said that starting a business is a political act and that the civil rights movement would be much farther along if we had focused on leveraging and increasing the building of small businesses. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I think it's an appropriate next step. You know, if gradualism at one point was an appropriate step and then activism was an appropriate step, I would posit to you, having been to Reverend King's memorial site in Sweet Arbor in Atlanta, that entrepreneurism is the next appropriate step, that bringing ownership and entrepreneurial process to great families and to great families with need is a great and civil rights empowerment strategy. Some would argue that Nifty is an application of Pastor Vernon Johns' strategy from the 1930s and 40s. And in essence, where economic self-determination is very, very key to us. And, you know, we're basically where the Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, hits the crossroad with Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And both of those authors agree on the premises of what we're trying to promote.
Mike Caslin is CEO and Executive Director of the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship. Mike, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Carol, it's a pleasure. I wish you great success.
Thanks. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says the new chic is no chic at all.
Growing up, my mother told me that I needed two things in life, a black tux and a navy blazer. That way, she assured me, I would always have something appropriate to wear. It's funny to think about that today and to contrast my mother's standard with contemporary styles. It's impossible anymore to characterize anything as inappropriate, no matter when or where it's worn. The new chic is no chic at all, and everyone likes it. A 2003 internet poll completed by the survey firm Business Research Lab found that half say the attire allowed by their company is so-called business casual, and for another 41%, it's quote-unquote very casual. Among the minority of 9% whose companies require traditional business attire, almost half would prefer more casual standards, whereas among those working at companies allowing casual dress, few see a need for change. It's not hard to understand these findings. We want to be comfortable. But I wonder about the extent to which our dress at work affects our attitudes towards work, as well as our attitudes about those around us. I suppose this sounds silly, even hopelessly old-fashioned, but I've come to think that my mother was teaching me respect for others, not fashion. A black tux and a navy blazer aren't just dressing up. They are one way of signaling respect for others, sort of like good manners, a way of presenting oneself to others that shows a consideration for and a commitment to courtesy and civility. Indeed, how we dress influences how we think of ourselves and thus how we act. 44% of the 1,000 managers interviewed in a 1999 survey sponsored by the employment law firm Jackson Lewis said that casual dress in their workplaces had led to greater tardiness and absenteeism. Additionally, they reported a rise in inappropriate flirtatious behavior. We act as we dress, it seems. Of course, other surveys report productivity gains from casual dress. But in this survey, at least, the percentage reporting productivity losses more than canceled out the 40% reporting gains. This is probably true in all cases. Gains are balanced out by the losses, resulting in a net productivity wash. What remains is a shift in the character of our interactions with others. Consideration for others has taken a back seat to comfort for ourselves. Incivility has become a defining characteristic of contemporary life, from shock jocks to road rage to ranting bloggers and talk radio hosts to the talking heads screaming on cable TV to cursing on primetime sitcoms to the appetites we have for gorging on paparazzi sensationalism and excess. Boorishness and bad manners are all around us, sweeping us up in a presumption that the worst is the best we can expect, as well as the best that we can do. Maybe a black tux and a navy blazer are too little too late, but still, it's something, and it can't be all bad to ask myself to behave as well as I look. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows at our site. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.